Now,
would like to give attention. Any clause, subclause that members would like to give attention to? None. Shall we then move to clause 9? And then subclause 8. Subclause B. So you must move fast. As well, because remember we've got time constraints. It is okay. All right. Let me reduce the speed. Okay. Clause 9 and sub clause 8. So input. Oh, going back to clause 8. All right. So which sub clause are you looking at, Professor Bozzoli?
C.
Okay. C, we have already done C last time. But
sorry,
we,
what is that? I mean,
So remember, today we starting at clause D. So you're fine. Alright. So let's agree, I'm not going fast. Okay, no, that's fine. So can we go to 9 now? Clause 9. Okay, clause 9. Subsection, clause, section, sub clause A. None. Nothing, eh? Sub clause B. Okay, we move on to clause 10. Sub clause A, B, okay.
Hey, Jefferson, in clause 10B, hey, taking the public comments into, I mean, the comment from Yusuf into account, we're proposing that Roman numeral 2, which says annually while holding office, must be deleted. And
okay, wait. Notwithstanding? Yeah. That's the one that you're talking about. Notwithstanding or B, yeah, okay.
Roman numeral two.
Currently, while holding office?
We're proposing that be deleted and that Roman numeral 3 be renumbered Roman numeral 2. And then in that Roman numeral 3 is contemplated in sub paragraph Roman numeral 1, and remove all 2, or Roman numeral 2.
Are you following, honorable members, and are you agreeing? Are we all agreeing? Well, I have to wait for you to give me an indication that you all agree. Agreed? I can't move here until you give me an indication which direction to take. Yes, Honorable...
Hello?
I agree, because what it does is it answers also the issue raised by another one of the presenters, which is this would impose quite a huge burden on universities. They have to get all of their staff to report every year on what their interests were. Now they're only going to have to report when they start and if there's any change. And that seems to me to be more practical. There's a fundamental problem here.
All right. Agree? I
We know what must be achieved. I just wanted to make sure that if we now go back to the document for easy reference that the department prepared for us, and the Honourable Mr. Patel is not listening. Okay, can I just ask, if we look on page 25, we have the adjustment there, and it's contained in red. That is when, it's only annually, it's only when there are changes, etc. Are there any new adjustments that he introduced now, apart from those captured in red on page 25? Is he just telling us about page 25? I just want to make 100% sure. Because sometimes in reference to sub 1, etc., you get a little confused, especially if he refers to an and or. Because in law, those two are very fundamental.
We're just confirming here on this. Thank you, Chair. To answer Honourable Member's question, on page 25 we suggest that there's an array, but just a technical further adjustments to this bit is removing as contemplated in some paragraph 1 or 2, because we've deleted 2. So we remove that, and that sentence will then stand on its own. Whenever a new interest not disclosed arises, declare any business, commercial or financial activities undertaken. So we remove in subparagraph 1 or 2. In subparagraph 1 or 2. I just want to say it's from it's contemplated because we've removed two.
So
sorry about that. Yes, so we and sometimes less than one or two. Yes. Because one just says before he or she assumes office. So the legal people can look at the legal clarity around it.
It is just the technical correct, and we will redraft it by taking out the words the section or the sub paragraph will read whenever a new interest not disclosed. Now we take out as contemplated in paragraphs one or two, and then it goes on arises. Then it just continues. So we just take out from. As contemplated to after Romans 2, comma.
Okay. Right. I just want to say that we should really deal with this in great can I say detail, because you know, sometimes because of legal processes that we put pressure on in Parliament, then in the end there are changes. And I really feel very uncomfortable. We already have seen some of the sort of minor, inaccuracies that have slipped in with references to law, etc. And I think we must just make 100% sure of the wording, that we don't just sit here and, you know, and think we agree, and then in the end we don't agree. So that's just my caution. But I think as far as this is concerned, it is now being duly clarified. Thank you.
I will read it again, but I also just need to mention that during the next round of discussion, where there is a formal vote, members will see it in writing also, and they can then verify it again that as well. It will be contained in the so-called ABLE, and the ABLE will specifically identify the exact wording, commas, everything included in it. Honorable Chair, I read it again. It will read as follows. It will be a new Roman 2. Whenever a new interest comma not disclosed, then we take out as contemplated in subparagraph 1 or 2, comma, we take that out, and then it continues, arises, comma, and the rest remains also the same.
And then we then move to subclause C. Subclause D. And then we move to, if you are satisfied, and then to subclause
5 subclause B, okay, to say that, but what it would read is as follows, 3A. If the Council of the Public Higher Education Institution fails to comply with any B condition subject to which any such allocation is paid to such institution, the Minister may in writing request such Council to comply with the provision or condition within a reasonable time rather than within a specified period. Just to soften it slightly.
Thank you, Chairperson. actually unclear whether the word specified as appears there. It refers to whether the enabling provision is allowing the minister to specify through the regulation, because we need then to get clarity from the statement whether it's specified as a power given to the minister to dictate what would be that time frame. Otherwise, if it's not, as the member has indicated, specified there is a bit confusing and not specifically expressing what they're talking of. Whereas if we go with reasonable would be justified and understandable in the terms of Pasha. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. I think since we're talking of a written request, Chair, it becomes clear then that the specified period would be the written request of the minister. But, Chair, when it comes to whether it should be specified or reasonable, because we're saying the minister requests the council to comply with that provision. So I don't know when how we will determine what would be a reasonable time, because it remains vague now. It's discretion how far we go when we say within reasonable time. So it's left at those decisions. We're not certain.
Okay, it's like the time
of the The way you're going about it, actually, practically, would be the minister to talk to the council and say what would be the reasonable time that you would be agreeable to fix this issue. And then they fix that time, and they agree on that time, then it's put in whatever the written request that the minister will send. Mm-hmm. Because once we leave it to uncertainty of reasonable time, so that we won't know within when that should be done, Chair. Specified, Chair, because it should be certified.
Chair, I want to support the legal advisor. Chair, Honourable Chair, it is important to note that Section 59 is dealing with the allocation of funds by the minister. It is dealing with the budget money going to the institution. And this is to ensure that the minister pay over the money after all the requirements have been met. If you are leaving it open, then it will affect the running of that institution. And the specified period is in a specific context, because there are specific subsidy payments that is part of the regulation. And this is just to clarify it and to provide a specific framework within which that information must be received, considered by the minister in order for that money to flow to the institutions. The concept of reasonable is a vague. It will leave a lot of discretion, and it is going to create a more of uncertainty, as was already referred to by the state law advisor. The specific period is not only bringing legal certainty, but it also supports the current framework within which entities are made.
Okay. With that explanation, okay, do you see what you would add?
Just a little bit, Chairperson. If the committee considers that we go with specified, I am looking at the use of the term may, then it says the minister may. Because if we're going with the may in writing as well as provide the specified period, if we leave it as may, then there is that room to say it leaves a discretion to say whether the specified period will be given in the written request or what then. Perhaps the consideration should be as well going further to say the minister must in writing through the request provide both the specified period as indicated, I think.
Yes, Chair. The problem with using must be there would be that in all instances now, the minister would be required to make that return request. The may relate to the minister making the return request. It doesn't relate to the specified period. So it gives the minister the discretion when this
circumstances call for it, then the minister should be able to do it. So it may relate to that chairperson. So that's
Chair, if the explanation given is that what will in practice happen is that the institution and the minister will decide together what a reasonable time or what the specified time is, why is that not what is put in the clause? Because it should then say within a time period to be agreed upon between the minister and the council.
What is a reasonable time period to be agreed upon?
A reasonable time period to be agreed upon between the minister and the council. I would prefer something like that rather than as a compromise between the two extremes, the one reasonable and the other one specified. It would be a specified time to be agreed upon between the minister and the council.
The problem that I have with this specific clause is that at times the council themselves would be best placed as to know how soon, what are the various circumstances that may exist at the institution for a provision to be complied with. There may be specific constraints that could prohibit that compliance immediately or within 7 days or whatever the case may be. And therefore, it would be better to have some sort of mechanism to say it must be a reasonable time, and that is a term that's used in various pieces of legislation, but a reasonable time that is agreed to between the minister and the council, which also outlaws or takes away the possibility of it being an extended period of time that is unreasonable, but it also would take into account what are the specific circumstances that would exist at an institution of higher learning that may constrain or delay compliance in this regard.
Any other input? We are debating between substitution of the city period with reasonable period. Then it has been accident presented to us by the legal technology in this meeting, so we need to resolve. The two other members spoken for this topic, and then what is that?
Chairperson, I actually, if you will allow me, can I proceed? I would stick to the specified, but we could consider perhaps something. I would like to hear what the department says about it. Should we say within a reasonable period as specified in the correspondence or whatever? First of all, I think it is necessary to have clarity about the period, because the minister, it relates to funding, and the minister is allocating funding and it may be queried, etc., that he needs to resolve. So I would suggest that we certainly retain the concept of specified, because then there's clarity for council and everybody involved. And I'm just asking if there is a way to reformulate that, or should we rather just, you know, use it as it is currently as specified in the written communication?
I do want to specialize the specified period. When it says the A, say, if the council of a public higher education fails to comply with the A, or then the like an intervention, the minister will say, okay, we are failed to comply, but can you then give reason for within this period?
No,
yes? Mm-hmm. If it fails, it has already failed, this member. So now the reasonable does not come in handy there. If it has failed, then you must then instruct them. In this period, I do want a response from this member. So it's an intervention. It's not like it's not deemed to the failure by country.
So I don't think it's necessarily asking for reasons. Each read that subsection says, conditions subject to which any such allocation is paid to such institution, the minister may invite him to pay such council to comply with the provision or condition within a specific period. I'll give an example.
and perhaps the legal advisors can correct me if I'm wrong. Let's say there's specific funding, let's use MISA's funding as an example, and it must be used for specific, under specific conditions. Maybe it's funding for disability students, retained funding for disability students, and let's say some of that funding for disability students went to students that are not disabled. That would then meet this criteria as a failure of compliance for of a provision or condition of public funding. Okay? Now, then the minister would then write and say, you need to comply with that condition or provision within a 2-week period or a 30-day period, whatever the case may be. But it will only be the council, in consultation with the managers at the institution, that will really understand the constraints. There could have been a mistake in the way allocations were made, but it could be a deliberate misuse of funds by managers at the institution. And to correct that and to comply with the provision, such as asking for reasons as to why compliance didn't take place, to then comply with the provision to make sure that that money is actually they used for disabled students and for other students that may have been competent already, whatever the case may be, it's a lot more complicated than first envisaged in that regard. Now, we all want the provisions to be complied with, Chairperson, but what I worry about is that we are now ignoring the complexities of the situation, when something wrong has taken place, when manager has failed in their fiduciary duties, when a mistake has taken place at an institution. And what that can do is it go down to 3B, 3B, A, and B, is that the minister can then withhold funds that could assist other students as well.
We must deal with a clause as a clause.
No, they
didn't. Explain ourselves in that and do not move.
No, they didn't.
No, but explain yourself there because we want to make sure that we are sending from there.
Yes, Chef, but you can refer to other clauses, you know.
But you must speak to the clause.
I'm speaking to the clause, I'm referring to other clauses which affect that clause.
Maybe if I may come in, maybe you're elaborating too much. Before you came with this, because we don't have time, can we at least discuss it to the point? So I think you've made your point and we appreciate, but let's give our members a chance also to talk to the next. Maybe, I don't know whether to allow the legal advisors to guide before I proceed. No, but Mr. Mbatat has not up for it. Alright. Great progress. Okay, I'm going to talk, ask them about one by one, I'm not just taking things, and then we allow the legal advisor to do it. Alright, Honourable Member Mbatat?
Thanks, Chair. My understanding of what maybe is trying or what is attempted to be explained here by clause is that we are not dealing with other extraordinary amounts that may be going to institutions, but we are dealing with the main standing, which is what you call institutional subsidy. And with due respect to my colleague Kasim, the relationship between the ministry and the institution relates to subsidy. The other supportive resources, the ministry has no authority. The institutions themselves have relationships with the institution, which means, for instance, whatever that are requests coming from the institution itself to NSFA, that cannot be determined by the ministry. My take here is one. Let's focus on what if the nation subsidy due to the institution, which must be authorized by the ministry, does not allow the ministry to act positively because of the inherent problems. Then we must ask ourselves if the reasonable law may attribute fairness to the institution to respond. But the reality is, the institution is already on the red. They did not comply. So it's not that there's something untoward. The institution has already made something that is not supposed to have been done, and the ministry is following up for correction. So ours as lawmakers is not to make an administrative determination. We have to make a legal determination that says, what is acceptable, what is admissible as fairness. Because immediately we try to do smaller things, then we are going with the dots. We will never manage legal things with the dots. That's my impression.
Thank you. Input, Honourable Member Nkulu.
Oh, thank you, Chair. For me, I think what the members are mostly concerned with is what we are going to, the consequence in 3B. Because the minister now may withhold money. So I think that one, we must retain it as is so that the council, the institutions may suffer consequences if they don't adhere to the departmental policy.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me also say, I think it is proper if the minister may withhold payment of those quotients, because maybe it will make them to do the correct thing, seeing that their payments will be involved.
In that. Retaining the word certified, remember we are amending.
We are retaining. Chairperson, just to say that we should retain specified. This relates to failure to comply with provisions of the Act as well as conditions for the subsidy. Now, if institutions are not complying with the specific conditions for subsidy payment, I mean, government operates on the basis of conditional grants and conditional funding. And clearly, if the institution is not adhering to those conditions, it is not a reasonable time. They are in fact transgressing the relationship, the agreement between government and the institution. So I would like to support specified should remain in place. Thank you, Chair. And then obviously, consequently, then we go to 3B. If it continues, then there must be consequences. Thank you, Chair.
Specified is what I go for, especially in an environment of transformation, that these institutions are operating and I mean, what is reasonable to cancel might not be the same that traders are for a minister to transform. So I would go for specified. I'm saying the environment is that of transformation. If you want to change, then you must be strong to change.
Chair, I suggested an alternative amendment where I said the time to be agreed upon between the minister and the council of the university, which can be specified, but it must be agreed upon. And in fact, this is echoing exactly what the state law advisor said. He understood would happen anyway. Universities are managed on a basis of cooperative governance. They are not managed like government departments. This would embody that spirit of cooperative governance. Nobody is saying that Clause 3B is being challenged, whereas many of the members have spoken as though that is the issue at stake. It is not the issue at stake. The issue at stake is simply, if a university does not comply with the ministry, how long do you give them before you take away their subsidy? And that length of time needs to be agreed between the university and the minister, not simply imposed by the minister, which allows a certain arbitrariness of time period into the relationship, which is not something that at the moment is present in the relationship between the ministry and the university. They are generally managed in a highly cooperative manner, and I do not believe that that should end with this clause. Thank you.
Then get the advice by the
I will say the issue of to be agreed upon is I think going to be problematic. We are dealing with a situation where it's already failure to perform, and to then get an agreement under that circumstance can be very difficult in practice. Legally, you always try to get agreement beforehand and not in an adverse situation, because motions take over, it affects processes, and it is going to make it very difficult. The safeguard is in the decision by the minister if this is a aspect where the institution failed to comply with. So if the institution think that administrative decision is a wrong decision, then they've got all the right in the world to take the minister to court and review that decision. But if they agree that this is a just decision, then the minister must have the legal authority to provide legal certainty in order to correct it, to make sure that it is possible to pay the money so that it won't have an effect on the students and the other running the operation of that institution.
I just want to add a policy context in regards to this. If this amendment is not introduced, the minister has no discretion about whole payment, because that's the way the issue in terms of the PFMA, in terms of what applies to the minister, is you kind of go over this if you fail. This particular clause has come about by the circuit itself, and in the public hearings and the submissions, none of them complained, because currently as it stands, without this amendment, the minister is duty bound not to continue paying those particular funds to the university. Now that is the principle in terms of which our finances operate in terms of the public and parliament in terms of DORA. And so this is in fact a leeway that is being granted, that at least there can be a discussion. For example, there may have been a commitment or something is almost going to be completed, etc. And this is a discussion that happens with the financial statement, as the financial and reporting on the conditional grants or any of the grants are concerned. So the issue is that this is actually in favor of the university by giving them a leeway in terms of still utilizing that conditional the grant outside the financial period.
Chair, as usual, Mr. Kassim has provided fantastic clarity. Thank you, Mr. Kassim. Patel. And Kassim, and always, and Kassim. Mr. Patel, because that intention was not made clear by the legal advisor, so I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairperson, you would know, even from my engagement in the last meeting, that I've always supported that, you know, we must be able to, as members of Parliament, to execute our mandate efficiently and as best as we can. I quite like Section 3D to say that the Minister must report a table reporting Parliament regarding any action taken under subsection DB. But then again, you know, after the debate we just had about time bound and so forth and how passionate members were around that, I believe that that principle should be applied here as can I be a protected citizen? I believe that that principle should be applied here as well. And I want to suggest that, I mean, it's not, if the minister has taken action under 3B, therefore he has withheld funds from an institution, public funds, it's not a very complicated process to inform Parliament and can specify that this is done in a period of 30 days. And I think that's more than reasonable. As members of Parliament, you know, if the minister has done this, I'm sure his officials can assist him with that. That that Parliament is informed that report as to how, why that funding was withheld from an institution is tabled in Parliament, not as soon as reasonably practicable after such action, but rather to tighten that within a period of potentially within a period of 30 days after such action under 3B.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to get an indication, maybe before I'm allowed to speak, what were the intentions of this intention? Oh, did it exist before, or is it new? Because for me, as far as I look at it now, side by side with the rest of the other clauses, it looks reasonably okay as an account of what has already become a decision. This is what we want as Parliament, in fact. But I want to know what are the inherent background issues so that we are guided like before.
Okay, so we have the legal advisor.
Mr. Patel is the only one who can give the history of why it's here. The legal guys just saw it in the document.
Thank you, Jay. We actually differentiate between what a legal technical issue versus what's a content and a policy particular issue. And I think this question is related to the policy. Look, I mean, I think this particular clause gives portfolio committee as well as Parliament an opportunity to look at why circumstances arose as to why funds were not spent within the time, and secondly, in terms of the actions taken by the minister. It is part of the oversight accounting particular process, because normally Parliament would manage appropriations based on a financial year, those appropriations that happen, and then all rollovers, all unspent money must be put back to the National Revenue Fund. So this is an opportunity, as we indicated, it's a bit of leniency to the institutions that if they haven't spent the conditions, there may be reasons where the minister may believe that the institutions will be able to meet the conditions, new conditions that are particularly set. But I think here the importance is that at least Parliament has an opportunity to look at what circumstances give rise to the non-compliance, but also how the minister dealt with that matter. And also it may empower the Parliament and the Portfolio Committee to later on look at whether the law needs to be tightened up in respect to that. Is it being too lenient, etc., in terms of specific cases? So it is an important reporting oversight mechanism to Parliament. And if I may say, I don't think that the issue, the proposal made the Honourable Kesem in terms of specifying a period would be problematic at all.
Are you happy with the explanation?
Yeah.
Can you now make the proposal?
Yeah. My proposal, Chair, is that if it fits the house or the collective here, I would like to see it remaining as is unchanged. Because for me, we need an empowered portfolio committee, an empowered institution called Parliament. And I think this is what we have been seeking all along, where we are not able to sense how these decisions were taken and to what extent were they meant for public good. I think at the end of the day, our interest is to make sure that these institutions and the decisions that affect them, it all remains for public good.
Chair, with respect to Mr. Mbata, can I just intervene? I think Mr. Mbata has misunderstood the intention of what our modification is. Our modification is to strengthen the hand of Parliament by saying the minister must report to Parliament within 30 days as to why he has done these things, so that we may further pursue our powers as a parliamentary committee. Not to weaken them, but to strengthen them further. And if Mr. Patel believes that these are not a problem, I don't see why other members would not support it.
Honestly, because I've been misunderstood, I've not changed anything in that session besides the time period. Because what is as soon as reasonably practicable? To be quite honest with you, after the debate we've had. No, let's be honest here. And I want to say something. In the past, and it's not just the department, the public entities as well, have promised us that the portfolio committee reports in a reasonable time. A year goes by, 2 years goes by. For as long as I've been in the committee, we have still not seen the report on the missing middle that Nasrallah had promised us. So way back, when he first came here to Parliament, what is reasonably practical? Now, this at least gives us certainty as a portfolio committee. And Mr. Patel has said it's no problem. It wouldn't be problematic to the department to have that report tabled within 50 days. And if the department doesn't see it as problematic, Chairperson, I think we as a committee should be acquiesced and would want to have some certainty in the work that we do, because otherwise it's very uncertain when we get it, what's going to happen, we have to go back and forth. There's no certainty and it's not problematic for the department. So the proposal is within a 30-day period.
I will not disagree, but I just wanted to say that after Professor Zulia and Mr. Kasim made such a passionate plea for the judicial term reasonable, I find it very interesting that they now want to specify time.
Shall we fall back the agreement on the work before us?
Yes.
Thank you very much. The agreement that you replace SNS reasonably practical with within 30 days of the fashion. Come again?
Because we could write it in such a way that it could in fact be sooner than 30 days, but not later, not longer than 30 days. You know, perhaps the minister would be in a position to immediately supply a report. But we could say within a reasonable period, but not more than 30 days after such intervention or whatever. You know, so I just wanted to hear what the exact...
Yeah, Honorable Killen is correct. You see, the problem with lawmaking is that you must always run away from becoming an administrative component of your same position. My take here is we are sometimes pursuing an argument that says we are and we may not be getting what we want from the department, and this is my honest view. So the attempt to place specific orders such as 30 days, 90 days, legally shouldn't be true. Let's use the words. However, 30 days to me becomes more specific when we are suspicious. Now, we must work from an environment where, let's say the DA takes over. Will the DA appreciate these 30 days, or it may even appreciate an action within 14 days, as they always say, they are efficient, or even 9 days? So, let's say you have an extremely efficient minister who takes public goods seriously. It may not even need 30 days. What is reasonable in your eyes may not necessarily be reasonable enough to somebody with passion for the cause. Somebody with passion for the cause may make some of these things even much more quicker.
Chair, the word within, I'm sorry, Chair, the word within means any time during 30 days. Within implies inside the period of 30 days. So it could be 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, 6 days, 20 days, 25 days, or 30 days. The word within is the crucial word here. Thank you.
I'm also speaking under correction here because I know that what we've got in front of us, the Hydration Amendment Bill, there were some changes that the department had made that might not reflect here. And I remember from the presentation last week, there was unless we change it. So they could correct me here. Under clause 16, the following section is hereby substituted to position 42 of the Principal Act. Under sub 42C, 42.1C, or 42.3C, I think it is. As the Minister may issue a directive to Council of a Public Education Institution, the Minister, after having complied with the provisions of subsection 3, has reasonable grounds to believe that the Council of the Management of that Public Education Institution has acted in an unfair, discriminatory, or wrongful manner towards the person to whom it owes a duty under this Act or any other law. I'm not sure whether that has been further edited. If not, Chairperson, I'd like to propose an amendment. And the reason why I'm doing so, Chair, first of all, I don't believe that it would pass or meet constitutional muster if the Minister can just decide if an institution has acted unfairly towards someone. What's unfair to one person is unfair to someone else. That's why we have laws and legislation to define what is wrong and what is right, what is unlawful and what is lawful. And if this wording is retained, particularly as acted in an unfair manner, if someone may feel that they've been unfairly treated for something arbitrarily, without any legal basis and any evidence, and if the Minister agrees with that person, the Minister can issue a directive to say employ that person or fire that person or whatever, any directive whatsoever as it applies to the institution. Like I said, Chairperson, I don't think that meets constitutional muster, and I would like to propose an amendment to say that as acted in a wrongful manner towards a person to whom it owes a duty under this Act or any other law, that would take into account legislation, particularly discrimination, which is well defined both within the Constitution and body of law. It would encompass all, if something unfair, it would have to be wrongful under law or under policies of the institution itself. It covers all of that, because the policy, the institution has its own policies and statutes that people must be protected under those statutes, and the Minister may issue a directive. If any person has been treated wrongfully in terms of, for example, the Constitution, the legislation of the country, the policies of the institution, policies of the department, and so forth, it would encompass all of that, and it would bring that clause, I think, in line with the intention of the clause, but at the same time, it would not provide for just the Minister to decide what is unfair and what is not unfair, which could change from Minister to Minister and from person to person as well. So that's my proposal, Chairperson.
Okay. So the proposal that we substitute unfair for discriminatory wrongful manner.
Can I just add an additional modification to exactly the same sentence at the same time, or would you like to just take it directly?
Why don't we give
it
a definition and then
Chair, I think my reading of this was under the impression that the ministry or the minister may not necessarily be acting outside anything substantial. And at some point when we were in the proceedings, one of the presenters indicated some insinuations around maybe a report from the assessor or something of that sort, and that the report from the assessor could request, as a result of his findings, could request certain action, and that action will obviously affect an individual, and that individual may request a review of the, I'm not sure if I'm getting it correctly, may request a review of what was found against him or her under the assessor. And then this, I may not be able to understand it under wrong, but I may be able to understand it better under the current heading as it is. But maybe let's get clarity from the officials. What were the stated assumptions when this was thought through?
Okay.
The issue here is that the minister is receiving a information which is not always easy to classify into different categories. This is a provision which provides the minister the opportunity before taking a decision to give that raw, unfettered information received through to the institution for them to respond to it. The actual decision will be only if you get to sub 4, where the minister then say, well, I've given you an opportunity, you haven't corrected it, now let's appoint an independent assessor to come in and investigate to see what is the your story, my story, and the correct story in order to deal with it in that way. There is ample opportunity built in terms of fairness for the minister first to give notice of his intention, the reason, the nature, and also the extent of the deficiency, what is the scope of it, and what you find in sub 2 is very, very critical. So it is not that it comes in with a decision to deal with what is the specific classification. But unfortunately, you deal with legislation, if you use the word unlawful only, then it is dealing with the issue which is purely provided by legislation. Sometimes you deal with policy issues which might not be in legislation, but it will have also a severe impact on the individual and the system. And that's why it is dealing with the unfairness as well as the discriminatory basis. Now, yes, wrongful is a process used in legislation, but the Constitution introduced unfair as a criteria as well as discriminatory practices. And it is not out of context. It's not that the wrongful, discriminatory and unfair is out of a vacuum that has now been given to the minister. It is relating to the functions of the individual institution in the relation to the complaint by that person affected by the action of that institution, and provide a fair opportunity to respond to whatever the nature, not becoming legalistic about is this wrongful, but to provide a meaningful approach to resolve the problem. And it is a precursor to get an outsider, an independent person, which was originally the only option available to the minister.
And to clarify something, Chair, because there seems to know there seems to be a misunderstanding.
But remember, I already moved.
I understand that. I just don't want the debate to be based on what I believe is a misunderstanding of what's said.
Okay. But you must be
wrong. I'll try and be as brief as I can, Chair, but that's not promising much. Chair.
Your dignity is Chair.
You don't have any Chair.
From Pedalborn.
Chair, I think there seems to be some sort of misunderstanding of what I've said and in relation to the section that we are discussing. Because we're not discussing the minister asking for clarity or trying to get stories or trying to get a written explanation. We're discussing a ministerial directive which under section 2 says that outlines the steps that the institution must take. Could be any steps, doesn't say what limits those steps. And if the institution does not comply or implement those steps as outlined by the minister in the directive, then the other section can kick in, we don't need to discuss that, it's fine. And also, I've not said unlawful. I actually discussed in my proposal to say that it would extend to policy issues, everything that Dr. Boshoff was speaking about as well. I just want to clarify that, Chairperson, so that we are debating on the same page.
Thank you, Jay. For me, I wanted to say we must retain these terms, unfair and discriminatory, because these terms are used in our constitution, and I don't see a reason why we need to try to find a more smoother way of putting things. We must be able to categorize that information according to those things, how a person has acted.
I am a gentleman of what we are putting across as we call it a consistent constitution. But is there any hypothesis that is consistent with the constitution of the right? Wait, was your hand up?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I can't see the concern that Honourable Kassim is raising here, and I'll tell you why. And it is because this is sort of information comes to the attention of the minister. He then puts out a directive to the institution in terms of subsection 2. Then he gives, in subsection 3, he gives the institution the opportunity to explain what is the issue. It gives the council a reasonable opportunity to make representations and consider the representations contemplated at sea. Only when at that stage it is clear that there's something wrong will it consider. And again, it's not immediate. That could be considered in the event that the minister has reasonable grounds to believe that the Council of the Public Higher Education Institution Concerned has failed to comply with the directive contemplating the section within a stated period, then there could be remedies. Now, I think if we look at this, it complies with administrative justice. There's an opportunity. Maybe the information was incorrect that he received or she received as minister, and then the rest of the process followed. Chairperson, I don't see the concern with regards to unfair and discriminatory. If we look at the Bill of Rights in Constitution, it is absolutely one of the cornerstones of the Constitution that there may not be unfair discrimination. There may be discrimination, but it must be fair. And because if we look at the Equality Clause, certainly it makes provision for specific persons who have been disadvantaged by unfair discrimination may now be advantaged in the new dispensation, that the Equality Clause 9. Thank you. That's right.
Unfairly, directly or indirectly against fairly discriminate directly or indirectly against anyone. Alright? Shall we make progress on this one? It does look like the majority view is that we retain unfair and undiscriminatory discrimination. Assessing an unfair, discriminatory or wrongful manner. So we believe wrongful manner. We don't
believe all of them. It's an alternative, Chair.
Yeah.
It's not the same old debate. I hear the arguments put forward around unfair discrimination as contained in the Constitution. And therefore, can I suggest a different wording? Starting from under Section 1, the Minister may issue a directive to the Council of a Public Higher Education Institution after having complied with the provision of Subsection 3 to take such action specified by the Minister if the Public Higher Education Institution, and then Section C, has committed widespread or serious acts of unfair discrimination. And I think that would encompass everything that has been included in this debate as well. No, it's an alternative, Chair, and we can debate that, but unfair discrimination is included, and Honourable Mbatha has said, well, his understanding of it was where there were substantial issues, and therefore, the wording to be inserted has committed widespread or serious acts of unfair discrimination. You must be noticed first, don't go to
as a point of order, sir.
I know you before that, so let's make it. Let's make order. What should it be? Of how parliament is run. What should be run orderly? And I'm sure we're all listening without mentioning names. Okay. All right. What do we say? Yeah, I'm not ready. Okay. Are you adding or supporting the us giving them unfair and discriminatory and wrongful? What the debate is about that? Yes, Honourable Professor, and then Honourable Member.
Chair, my view is that the real problem with this part of the Act, or the bill, is actually around the word reasonable once again, rather than, I'm happy to concede on unfair discrimination, that's fine. Let's just talk about the word reasonable. What has happened is that in the old Act, if the minister wanted to put a university under administration, he had to have, as the drafter of the Act, who is not here today, the drafter of the bill, suggested, if the minister wanted to put a university under administration, he had to have proof that there was something bad going on. And what this does now is that it says the minister simply has to have reasonable grounds to believe that there is something bad going on. Now, that extends the minister's powers quite substantially, because what it says is, the minister simply has to believe reasonably that there's something going on. In other words, someone just has to come to him maybe and say, you know, that vice chancellor was really bad, he fired me in an unfair and discriminatory manner. And then the minister would have reasonable grounds to believe that unfair and discriminatory practices have been taking place at the university, and he could issue a directive. So it loosens up the control over the minister quite substantially and extends his powers quite substantially. He doesn't have to have actual evidence. He simply has to have grounds to believe, which can be his own opinion. So we are not happy with reasonable grounds to believe, and we think that what was in the old Act was fine in terms of that sentence, and simply should say the minister may issue a directive. We just want the minister to have to show that there was, he doesn't have to have proved it in a court of law, but he has to be able to show that there actually was substantial or widespread financial impropriety or inability to perform its functions or unfair discrimination or a failure to comply with laws in a serious or widespread manner or failure to comply with the directive, or seriously and repeatedly and wrongfully obstructed the minister. In other words, the difference between us and the department on this is we believe the minister should be more seriously obliged to address the question of why he is issuing these directives, and more importantly, why later, if those directives are not followed, he puts the university under administration. All of those at the moment are subject to reasonable grounds to believe, because the minister wants, because, as his advisor, Ms. Allais, said in an article written by him by her defending the bill, the minister wants greater powers to intervene. He's given himself greater powers in this bill, and we think the powers, while we accept the idea that there are universities which are real problems and that issuing a directive and asking for responses to the directive is a very good move, we think introducing reasonable grounds goes too far in the other direction
and that the minister powers need to be pulled back to a middle position, not as difficult to implement as they were in the old act, but not quite as lenient as they are in this bill. So if anyone misunderstands, we are not saying the spirit of these causes is something we oppose. We're simply saying they go too far in the other direction. Thank you.
I'd like to allow the state law advisor to come in because I think he will have some of the issues raised by one of the people.
Thanks, Chair. The correct legal position, Chairperson, is goes opposite to what the honourable member is putting forward, Chairperson. When there's a reasonable test put into a provision, Chairperson, where it says you must base your decision on reasonable belief, it means you must have justification, you must have reasons, valid reasons. So if there is no reasonable belief, it means your decision making is subjective. So the opposite of what she's saying is actually true, Chairperson. Reasonable belief requires that you have reasons. So it's justiciable. There are a number of cases that put a legal position forward, Chairperson. Thanks.
Any decision making should be informed and informed by the
Just to come back on that point.
Yes.
Chair, on that point, our legal advice is not that. Our legal advice is that reasonable grounds to believe, legally speaking, not in terms of ordinary language, in terms of legal language, reasonable grounds to believe in administrative law is not confined to the need to produce evidence. It does mean that a certain amount of subjective opinion may be introduced. So we are not in agreement, legally speaking, with the state law advisor on this one.
But it would be wrong for any leader to take decisions based on science.
But that's what they
are. You know, I think it would be wrong, but I think the explanation that is given, actually, it's not too practical, it's a standard practice. We don't take a decision without exhausting all avenues that we take a decision. In terms of decision making tree, you exhaust all avenues and take a decision. This is an informed decision. You know about the decision making tree. You don't have to take a decision. It's informed.
Chair, our legal advice is that this is not the case. In this case, this actually softens the requirement on the minister to have evidence. Evidence-based decision-making is not contained in the word reasonable. It can be subjective. So therefore, we are not happy with this clause and this wording in this bill. Thank you.
I take the point. I note your point. And then shall we then have Honourable Member Kian and then Honourable Member Mark.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I just would like to say I do not agree with Professor Pedoli that it is worse than the previous set of provisions in the Act. In fact, the previous Act in Section 42 allowed essentially for 3 steps. It said, Minister may call upon such councils to comply with the provision or condition within a specified period. Boom. Then, step 2, the minister may withhold payment of any commensurate portion of any allocation. That's the second step. And 3 is, before taking action, the minister must give them an opportunity to say something, and then he must just consider it, whatever they have in mind. And the point that we are bringing in now is, it's far better, because now the issue, again, I come back to the wording of reasonableness. We've had this earlier on, we said in law, reasonable has a specific meaning. So he cannot just willfully come in. He must believe on reasonable grounds that there is unfair discrimination that is taking place. So he can't just, with every concern that is raised by an individual, just dump on their counsel and take action and issue a directive and then, in fact, withhold money, etc. So I would like to argue that this before us the amendment bill, the provision of section 42, which is clause 16, is a far improved one. And the second point that I just wanted to make is that I feel it is important for us to know that this may be the DA's legal opinion. Now, that is why we have a very, very well-established judiciary in the country, Chair, because people differ from opinion. But I think what we know is we note the concern that the DA has, but I think we can feel, as a committee, we can feel comfortable that this is an improved provision that is brought in because it's based on reasonableness. Thank you.
Okay, Honourable Member Mbatha.
I think I'm going to assist. I may not be able to make peace with the DA, but let me say what I'm going to say. In my
and then the rules.
Yes.
On the majority,
I happen to have the experience where things were a little bit too open before, as related by Honorable Killian. This will make the minister, for instance, the definition of unfairness requires evidence of what was not fair. The definition of what is discriminatory requires evidence of what is fair and what has become discriminatory. Now, all those terms are interrelated and they are legally allowing the minister to use that, whatever the evidence is. Now, we, on a legal term, we are not allowed to make a determination on the type of evidence. We are allowing and permitting the ministry to act reasonably. So, my take is, reasonable grounds may not necessarily tell oral evidence alone. It requires more than that.
Okay.
You must protect me. The professor is on fire. She's on fire.
Well, we must call the professor. Okay, no, that's fine.
Look, I think we all agree in the substance of what should take place. And I think where the disagreement comes in is as to the actual terms that are contained in the bill and what is the effect or unintended consequences that is feared from those terms. I don't see a substantial disagreement from my analysis of the inputs as to what needs to happen in these type of situations. And therefore, I'm trying to understand why we need to say, as reasonable grounds to believe, that the minister has to have the reasonable grounds to believe, as a professor, why can you not just say, the minister may issue a directive to the Council of Public Higher Education Institution, if the minister having complied with provisions of subsection 6, and the council management of that public education institution, A, is involved, B, is unable to perform, C, is active, whatever. Why must that specific section be included? The substance of all the inputs that I've heard here today, Jefferson, doesn't necessitate that. What it necessitates is that these conditions of A, B, C, whatever, can happen at an institution which would necessitate a directive from the minister. And therefore, Chairperson, in order to clean up that confusion, because clearly even here there's confusion, even amongst legal advisors there's confusion and differing of opinions, let us just take that out and just say that that should happen where a council or the management of that public higher education institution, A, B, C, D, must happen where those things take place. And that would clear that it would include the substantial aspect of what the committee has been speaking about. Where these things happen, clearly the minister should have room to issue a directive.
Well, on the point that you have observations about most of the members
agree on us retaining the word unfair, discriminatory, all of them. When we look at the constitution, we find that the same words have been used in the constitution. So therefore, we cannot go wrong if we use the same words that are consistent with the constitution. So shall we then move on with the data presenting that we will change all these words that we will feel here? I don't remember, Professor Pozzoli?
Chair, we have a third concern about this clause. So the first concern was unfair and discriminatory, which I think we've agreed can remain. The second concern was reasonable grounds, which we are not happy with, and our legal advice is that this is too vague and can open the situation up to abuse by an unscrupulous minister. Okay. Not that we have an unscrupulous minister, but should such a minister come in, it could be open to abuse. I'll just need to leave it at that, because I think we're going to disagree on this. And then the third one is that we think the grounds do remain, perhaps are too broad. Okay, so let's just look at financial impropriety. Okay, so the first one says financial impropriety. We think that financial impropriety, I mean, that could mean that three items on audit of that university were queried by the auditor. That's all it means. There's no definition of how much financial impropriety. It could be three things. So we would like it to be extended to saying substantial or widespread financial impropriety. We don't want the minister intervening in the university when there's a minor infraction. That's dealt with by the council and the auditors. It's not dealt with by the minister. He shouldn't have to intervene when there's, you know, a small issue of, I didn't say 10 million. A small issue of three rand. That could be counted as financial impropriety. £3 mistake in your toilet roll bill could be incorrectly think. Is a minister seriously going to intervene and override the governance powers of the council when there's this opens up to any financial impropriety? So we're saying substantial or widespread financial impropriety. Secondly, we are concerned about acts of unfair discrimination, because those acts of unfair discrimination, again, could be minor, and most universities, in fact all universities, have appeal mechanisms against discrimination internally, which are managed by the council, and again it should not have to be intervened in by the minister unless they are substantial and widespread. So we would like to extend that to widespread and serious acts of unfair discrimination, rather than just acts of unfair discrimination, which could be anything. Okay, and then we think that has failed to comply with any law. Now again, the law might say your kitchen needs to be kept clean, and a university might not be keeping its kitchen clean, and therefore it's not complying with that law. Are we seriously saying that's grounds for a minister to intervene? No. We're saying such failure must be serious or widespread before the minister has the right to intervene. And the last one is obstruct the minister or person authorised the minister to perform a function. Again, seriously and repeatedly and wrongfully obstruct the minister or a person authorised by the minister to perform a function in terms of this act. We cannot allow the ministers to start intervening in universities on trivial grounds. They have their own governance systems, and those must be respected. Up until the point where governance is widespread, you know, in a widespread manner, is deficient. So this opens the way up for the minister to intervene too quickly, too easily, and based on his own opinion, and we believe the entire clause does need to be rethought. Thank you.
Okay, I know that earlier on the argument is the minister will not just take a decision unless there is sufficient, you know, ground for him to decide. So, okay, as we take this discussion further, shall we then be further clarified on the issues that are raised by honourable member for this? I know that the minister, one top document that the minister is taking into consideration before making the decision, even your auditor and make a statement. But it was not done. And then remember, when the company's report, that's when you will get information. And also, he will also get information on the
yeah. You're assuming this wonderful, ethical, highly responsible minister who's going to do all these things. The law has to assume other things. The law has to assume that universities need protection against willful and interfering ministers, because such people do exist in society. And that is what we are worried about. Situations where you start getting ministerial intervention in universities, which are not justified. The law needs to protect them against that.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to ask all the legal people that are around on the delegation this side to please bring the attention of the committee. And I think need guidance. Should we be debating something that has not changed? That's the issue. And if that is fine, that's fine. But I just want to draw the attention of the committee to Section 49A of the Act. This wording has not changed from that. It's moving a section from 49A to here. In fact, it strengthens those clauses that were there. 49A did not give the minister even reasonableness. He could just issue a directive. Now, in consultation with the sector, this is where the cleanup has been. But the fundamental principle is that there were places in the Act in which there wasn't reasonableness specified or administrative justice. And the main purpose of this Act is to bring about administrative justice on the part of the minister. So it's actually, if the minister required more powers, he's going to make the amendment and to keep it as the Act is. So I just want the legal people to please, because I think the way that the bill is drafted, it's as if, when it's a substitution, it's as if it's a new clause that needs to be debated, but that's not the... So for example, if you look at clause 49A1C, it has acted unfairly or discriminatory or inequitable, and that's the only thing that has been changed in the substitution to wrongful way. The issue of financial impropriety is exact as it is in the current Act. And it's not being changed, it is just being moved from one section to another. Thank you.
Right, I'll allow the legal advisor from Parliament to legal advisor.
Thank you, Chairperson. Having had all that has been said with regards to Section 42 amended by Clause 16, basically, Chairperson, I would say the overbroadness and the overbreadth of the current provisions that they are bringing to the mandate and the functions of the minister in this regard should be welcomed by the committee, because as it is overbroad, it actually permits many more other instances that perhaps could not be covered if not specific to the certain weight. But with the way that has been explained and indicated what their legal implications and extent are, it actually enables more scope to the minister to bring in administrative justice as well as properly go through the process of intervention and having to decide whether an administrator is necessary. Looking furthermore on the words used that have reasonable grounds, it basically says the minister cannot willingly act without having information and justification to justify and provide reason for having taken whatever decision he takes to say, this is the kind of action I'm going to take in this regard. You can't just take it without reasons. And that's what basically the phrase, as you say, is saying. It says, act with having had regard to reasons. Reasons which you can provide when necessary to say, I acted in this manner based on the following reasons. And that is what basically reasonable grounds means, and because it has been personalized to the office or to the incumbent that's holding the office of minister, it doesn't really make it wrong in that sense, but it basically says the person in that office, you must have reason to justify your act. You must have reasons to justify your decision. And therefore, in that regard, I would say the provision as is, it provides the necessary overbreadthness that must encompass all and everything, but also expresses what is that, and the principle of legal certainty in legislation is actually covered by the current provision as it appears there. Now, taking further the suggestion that we must have the extent or the level that defines what is unfair and what discrimination, to say it's serious or overspread or widespread, it brings the question again of the criteria, and who are they who will have to decide on that? Must it be the minister? If the minister says this is serious and this is not serious, what criteria is given to me to actually be within the ambit that in the jurisprudence has been given, that when you give us discretion, there must be a criteria at least to control and retain what you are saying the person must decide, where in instances it will have adverse implications. Because if we bring those levels which now define what's the extent of unfair and what's the extent of discriminatory, how is that going to be controlled? Because that whole thing is like given to the one person, the minister, who must decide what he does, and must also decide the extent, whether this thing is now widespread or still contained and limited. And in that regard, it also allows room to say, wait for the problem to expand before you act, before you bring in the intervention. So you must only act once there is a problem that is now destroying the universities or is not taking forward the process of higher education and what needs to be done. So in other words, it says, allow the problem to be out there and be known before you act. It actually inhibits the intention of what we are trying to correct the mischief in this regard, Jefferson. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. You know, Chair, there's been a number of provisions of legislation passed by Parliament that have been struck down on the basis that the discretion that is given on the minister is subjective. Now we bring in a reasonable justification into legislation, it's still criticized. I don't understand it, Chairperson. The Constitution in Section 32, 33, Chairperson, it says everyone has a right to administrative action that is lawful, that is reasonable, that is procedural fair. Reasonableness is a constitutional requirement, Chairperson. I don't know anything who will say reasonableness is something that is unknown in legal parlance, Chairperson. We know what reasonableness is when we talk about reasonableness. Courts know what reasonableness is. They've defined what it is. We know what we're talking about, Chairperson. Thanks.
Chair, I just want to add to my two colleagues. I think the issue of reasonableness is actually the opposite of when you act on your own. Because there you might have an objective reason, a rationale, which is not just your own beliefs. Because it is that person that has reasonable beliefs, not his own beliefs. If it was own beliefs, it's a different issue. But here the issue of providing additional words that under the grounds where it is serious, widespread, that type of terminology. I wonder what my colleague said about the minister must now make that call. How could the minister make that call if he can't get clarity by asking the council what is going on? Provide answers to these things so that I can determine what is the seriousness of it, what is the widespreadness of it. How do you deal with it? How would the minister perform this function if he don't have the leeway to put in the complaint that he received to the institution to say institution respond to that? Because the issue of seriousness, the issue of widespread, might be more of an issue when it comes to the appointment of the independent assessor and the administrator, because then you can deal with the issues that, or the examples raised of £3 on the deficiency in terms of the audit report. Now, Chair, I don't think any minister, any reasonable minister, will be justified to, on reasonable beliefs, to say that a deficiency of 3 rand is grounds for him or her to make a decision. Because that is the essence of reasonable belief, is that it must be in the context. It must be something substantial. It must be something with weight. That is what reasonable also included. The concern that the Honourable Member, Professor Brazzoli, has raised is actually protected by the word reasonable belief, and it is not actually doing a wide interpretation to the question.
All right, I think we debated this, and I think there's now clear understanding on why we should leave this position without adding many words to it. Because legally speaking, all those who for the legislative understand the word, the reasonable because it is also aligned to the constitution or to the constitutional order. Right? Please, honour member, allow me now to assist me to wrap up this so that we can move on to the other floor. Professor Bogoli and Honourable
Yeah, with respect to the legal advisers, I actually believe that their opinions differed between each other. My colleague over here suggested that the trouble with the old Act was that it wasn't broad enough and this introduces desirable breadth, which is exactly what we are saying. Whereas other legal advisers have said, no, well, it doesn't make all that much difference, which is, makes me wonder why introduce it. And then I also would like to quote the, is it Professor Roux who advised the department on the bill? Professor De Vere. He actually, this is a direct quote from him in a previous session where he said, under the previous Act, the Minister had to prove his case when he wanted to intervene in the university. That was too onerous, and we would like him now to be able to intervene in the university without the requisite proof, but with an opinion that he has that this is necessary. This is what he said. So I cannot believe that the department's intentions are only, you know, to be reasonable and to restrict the minister and to assume this wonderful reasonable minister when your own legal person said we want to move away from requirement of proof towards a looser requirement, and where Dr. Anais, the minister's advisor, has written in an op-ed published widely by the department that what this Act seeks to do is extend and strengthen the conditions under which universities can be issued directives and put under administration. So the intentions of the ministry are being presented in a contradictory way, and the legal advisers contradict one another. So with your fact, Chair, I don't think we've reached a point where we all agree with the clause as it is currently. Thank you.
Okay, I'll comment on that.
And you know, I had the same problem last week with the state advisor, in fact, and I had raised it at the time, that in fact he wasn't even reading the Act correctly at the time. I raised it at the time, and I have the same problem here as well, that person. Having said that, when I look at the Act, the original Act as it is, because Mr. Patel has asked us to refer back to, I've got it in front of me as well, what is struck out. The Minister may issue a directive to the Council of Public Higher Education Institutions to take such action specified by the Minister if the public higher education institution A is involved in financial, B, etc., etc. And I think that's all the substance of what we've been discussing as a committee. We want, if these things are taking place at an institution, to give the Minister the room or the space or the right to issue a directive in this regard where those things are taking place. Now, why change that? Well, what exactly, unless it is really to create a subjective test. There's no other reason to change that, unless one wants to create a subjective test, because in the Act as it stood, if those things are happening, the Minister can issue a directive. And I want to reaffirm, Chairperson, that we should keep it like that, subject to the provisions of subsection 3, that the minister may issue a directive to the Council of a Public Higher Education Institution to take such action specified by the minister if the public higher education institution, and then go A, is involved in financial impropriety, B, etc., etc., and so forth, which would keep the substance of what we've been discussing this whole time. There's absolutely no reason to include clauses that can be viewed as subjective in nature when it was fine as it was. And if those conditions are there, the minister can issue a directive. Nobody is disputing that. The minister must be able to issue a directive.
With the explanation provided that the directive is issued by the minister, but it should be reasonable, I thought initially the way I understood Professor Bozoli's concern was that what if the minister is in essence some kind of a dictator, and I don't think dictators allow for reasonability. In a situation of a dictator, directive is given, the person who gives directive doesn't care the rationality behind his action, he just does things haphazardly, so to say. But there's an ability to guarantee that there's a reason, there's a cause why he's taking the action that he's taking. So when there's reasonability, the way the legal people are explaining it, I think it by all means exclude any dictatorial kind of action. And really, the concern from opposition falls off as far as I'm concerned, because that is actually safeguarded by the way the reasonability. So really, if there's a directive and it is reasonable, I don't see how subjectivity comes in there.
I think what will help us as we deal with these amendments that are before us is that we should deal with them with maximum objectivity and avoid trying to advocate on behalf of universities, but consider what will be in the best interest of the country, the sector, and subsequently the country. I think that's what I would then request from honorable members. Let's leave the universities aside and then we look at what will be in the best interest of the sector and also of the country. I think that will assist us in time. Shall we then move on to the next clause, which is D? We're busy with clause 42, subclause 1, and it's 16. We still have derived 42 of 5. Alright. Shall we? Do you still want us to debate? Is clause 17?
No, we haven't finished with clause 16, I'm afraid.
Okay, alright. Shall we then proceed with the sub clauses that you want us to consider, read, consider, and resolve on?
Okay, Chair, the worrying section 4 is something that we would like to raise. This is what it says. In the event that the Minister has reasonable grounds to believe that the Council has failed to comply with the directive, or steps taken failed to remedy the deficiency within a reasonable period of time, the Minister may appoint an independent assessor or appoint an administrator or take any other appropriate action allowed by this Act. So, once again, we are at the reasonable grounds to believe question. And I would argue that while in the first clause, one could argue that just issuing a directive could be done on a reasonable ground, appointing an administrator is an extremely serious thing, where a council actually gets abolished a vice chancellor gets abolished, and the university is essentially taken over by the government. And for that to be subject to two things, A, reasonable grounds to believe, and B, things that the university has done that are not widespread and serious, it seems to me to be really too lenient upon the minister. So issuing a directive was the first area where reasonable grounds to believe was it. Now we have a much more serious area where the phrase reasonable grounds to believe has been introduced. And again, reasonable grounds. I mean, a minister could be approached by somebody who says to him very persuasively that I was not appointed because I was a woman, which is unfair discrimination. He could reasonably believe that, and he could then put the university under administration. He then finds out afterwards that actually that person was not appointed because she had stolen money, not because she was a woman, but he can't reverse it. Now we will find the university under permanent administration. There is no council, there is no vice chancellor, there is no way for him to just suddenly take all of that back. So he's taken a very drastic step in relation to your university. He has abolished the autonomy of that university. I would argue that in doing that, he really has to be convinced in a much more fundamental sense than just having reasonable grounds. He needs to have proof, he needs to have substantive proof, and the deviations from the directive have to be significant and widespread and not trivial. And I don't believe that's covered in the act, in the bill.
Thank you. Okay. That was Professor Bozoli's input. Any other input on the clause that Honourable Member Bozoli spoke to, sub-clause, which is your sub-clause B, 4, and A, sub, is a sub-clause D, and sub-clause 4, and then A. Okay. I don't remember, Killian.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I really cannot see the concern that Honourable Zoli has raised. First of all, again, if we look at the current Act, it says that if the Council fails to comply, that's Section 49A, 4A, if the Council fails to comply with the directive within the stated period, the Minister must dissolve the Council and appoint an administrator to take over the functions of the Council. So the Minister didn't have any opportunity to first consider the reasonableness of the issues raised with them. Now we are bringing in the reasonable test. That's the first thing. The second thing is, there's a gradual, depending on the extent, clearly, the minister must prove, if he wants to, first of all, he has to consider, depending on the circumstances, he may. Now, A, appoint an independent assessor. And we know that there's an independent assessor, there's a group of people who will be recognized as independent assessors. There's a panel. Now, he should do that now to determine and get on reasonable grounds the extent of the alleged transgression. So we are improving the measures that the minister can take so as not to, as is currently the case, he must dissolve the council. So it's far more onerous to keep the current piece of legislation intact and the provisions of the current Act than to move with this steady retention of fair administrative action, financial propriety, etc. at institutions of higher learning. We all know what the situation is. So clearly we have to give him the necessary opportunity to intervene, but on reasonable grounds, and not just at his own whim. And I think we are introducing such measures. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Any other input? Honourable Member Ketana?
Just a quick last thing from me. For me, if people justify their action, I don't see the danger of falling prey to a democratic kind of rulership. I mean, my knowledge is that demagogues don't justify. They at will do just as they wish, and you can't even question, and they don't have to explain themselves and justify. Now, if here there's reasonability, which means you must justify, that actually holds their hands, the minister's hands, from doing as they wish. And I really don't see how better we can improve this. If people have to justify their action, then it covers me as a human being. I feel safe. And that is the end of it.
Okay. That was Honorable Ketana's input. So, how are we? Do you want to come in? Can please advise us on this?
Yeah. It is important to identify the also the concepts that we've discussed in the earlier part of this whole issue of interventions. The one aspect that was mentioned is that the minister is bringing in his own views and a lot of power, and also that the university is actually taken over by government. It is not the case. The issue here is that the interventions that is in the current act is basically repeated in this one, as Mr. Patel already referred to. It is further, it is strengthened by spelling out the underlying principle that's in the current one by including the specific procedural requirement as is required by FISA, and which also strengthens the concept of reasonableness and justification for your administrative decision. It then further deals with the same context of it's not the minister taking over a university under administration, that he appoints an independent, totally outsider. It's not as there was never ever an administrator appointed that came from the department or departmental officials. They are all peers in the university sector that have been appointed. So it's not the government taking over. That the intention is also never to place it under permanent administration. The issue here is to provide the institution to get back onto track, to get a new council in place in order to deal with governance as intended in the legislation. So, Chair, there's a lot of these concepts that have been put on the table, which is a bit confusing, but the aspect or the reality of this amendment is it is within the same parameters that is provided in the current legislation. It is exactly the same objective where the minister do have the right in terms of the legislative framework to intervene under specific and specified conditions and frameworks, and reasonableness is the accepted driving force when a decision maker must make that kind of decision. So, Chair, the concept, as Ed already explained, is by debated by the committee, is also applicable here. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, I will allow the legal advisor for Parliament to also make a contribution.
Thank you, Chairperson. I might have missed maybe some information when nature called. But Chairperson, I just wanted to come in indicating just three things here. That if we look at the 42 sub 4,
as provided. It actually provides three types of interventions that the minister, one with the information, may decide, and with the reason as which to go with in terms of what is the situation at that specific university. The first one in A, it says appoint an independent assessor. And if we look at the process of appointing the independent assessor and what it is that independent assessor will do, the independent assessor will conduct an investigation. An investigation which thereafter will provide findings as to what exactly is happening, and then enable the minister to then take an appropriate intervention based on the information and the investigation that the independent assessor has actually conducted. The second form of intervention is where an administrator is appointed. And if we look at 49B as well, to see what is the task and what is the point of appointing an administrator. In this instance, the appointment of the administrator will indeed take over the authority of the university authorities. But for specific reasons, as pointed out in 49B, which if we look at it in context and in content, it deals with financial misconduct that is going to affect the university moving forward. Therefore, these two interventions by the minister, I think in content and context, we are missing the point that the assessor, the independent assessor, as has been indicated, has nothing to do with the ministry or does not come from the department. But if we look at 44, it defines and spells out exactly what is required of an independent assessor, as well as 49B defines what is required and what would be the task of the administrator that is appointed after following the due process. So I think in terms of that, those two contexts were missed out, and then if we can see, then C is an all-encompassing phrase, which basically says once the minister has done due diligence to find that something is not going well, in terms of the act, because we must understand in terms of the supreme law of the country and the legal principle, the ministry or any other branch of government cannot act and do something without it being authorized by some form of legislation or statute. And in this regard, I think the three interventions as indicated there, they are confined and are applicable and are also complying with the law. It will not be done abstractly. That would be my input.
I think we have to agree to disagree on this because I'm afraid we're not persuaded.
Honourable Member, otherwise we agree, we take note of the fact that Honourable Professor Bologna did not agree. And Honourable Member Katim did not agree. Did not agree.
I just want to ask, in terms of the procedures that we're using here, because when we started this process last week, I was looking for my notes very quickly, but when we started this process last week, there were specific sections, if you remember, that we had parked, like on the definitions of the public university, and there were others as well. And then we said, as a committee, we will come back to that as well. So from the way I'm seeing the proceedings today, have we deviated from that method of proceeding? Are we now evolving as we continue with the majority rule? Or are we looking disagreements and then parking those as well? It's a clarity for yourself, Chair, but I'm not going to work here.
I know that the department will still provide information on those things that we have. And if you want to make a proposal for the I request that this one be packed so that the leader of the can go and specify the government contract. If you do your I can propose from you want to persuade, and what you are proposing, you are this particular session. You have to take consideration later. Because the session is really, really considering the government.
Thank you for your prediction, Chairperson. Chairperson, what I understood, and I thought it was that we were making progress along the lines of if there was a general consensus amongst parties that this or that provision needs to be reworked, then we have given it over to the legal team. However, as far as the rest is concerned, we can't park everything that either the DA or ANC or whoever is not satisfied and we're not convinced the others. So my understanding was only those sections that we have had multi-party agreement that needs to be reworked, they would be blocked. But the others, we will still get to the formal adoption clause by clause, but as far as I understand, it doesn't help that we park the entire Act, Amendment Bill, as we move through it. So as far as this is concerned, we've not been convinced, and therefore, with great respect, but I think that is how we can move through the different clauses of the Amendment Bill. Thank you, Chairman.
No, Chair, thank you. I think we are progressing well. I want to second what Comrade Honorable Killian is saying, because really we agreed there was consensus on issues that had to be packed. And if we are packing everything, then the packing is going to be full, and we're not going to do anything.
Yeah, Chair, I also don't see the declaration where it is, because the first choice obviously is to have a consensus, but if there's no consensus, then that is reasonable. I mean, people will disagree if they want to disagree. That is why the democracy, so that if there's disagreement, you check what is the general will. But the other point is that when we talk, and the legal people are all here, and they don't think what we're talking, there's any further work they can do, they've exhausted it. Now, why do you want them to take it back to offices and rework while right here they're telling you, look, we think we've reached the ceiling here, we have exhausted all angles of this argument. So, I mean, ultimately, we've got to continue as government and complete what we need to complete. But yes, as parliament. But the issue is that the first choice is consensus, but if Professor Pozzoli and Kasim, Honorable Kasim and Honorable Professor, Kasim will always agree with Professor Pozzoli. If they don't agree, ultimately for the sake of progress, we as a committee have to agree and continue. But indeed, we can pack and pack and pack, especially when the legal people say, there's nothing we can do.
Okay. Yes, and I'm actually disappointed that you did not intervene when Honorable Kikana can make such insinuations about honorable members in the committee. To say this one will always agree with that one and that one will always agree. It's not his role to do that, number one. It's the work of ANC, it's not my work. And secondly, maybe he thinks he's in government, but he does not have the right. Chair, you must go into order. You must not have the right to say this one will always agree with that one, and this one will always impart insinuations on other members' behalf. It's not his place to do that. I take extreme exceptions to that, Chairperson.
Can we please rise above our political party lines and then deal with these matters with maximum objectivity and with less emotions?
Can you please ask him to withdraw? That's what I'm asking.
We can make good progress. Okay, where you referred to the two members and you compared them, shall we, Honourable Whip, shall we find a way of correcting? Going and correcting, what's the difference? It's a corrective measure.
Unconditional
change. Ooh, are you too hard now? What's the problem?
No, it was an observation, but if it offends, this is an offense. If it's offensive to you, that is my observation. If it's offensive, I withdraw. Is that fine?
Yes, it's fine. Thank you very much. And then, shall we? Okay, honorable member.
Check. Let maybe use your famous opening line that we have, at least as a committee, established through the advice of Professor Nzima, Honorable Professor Nzima. I think if we go back to your opening remarks, you will find that without me having to mention the amount of time we spend on this clause in particular and these areas, because I don't think time is fair to any law, I think you must now use your discretion. Have we arrived? Have we met all the suggested processes during this discussion, and do you think is it enough, is it fair to proceed when even there is at least consensus? There is consensus, Chair. And because consensus in this instance is not going to be created by two dissenting members. Consensus is going to be created by the majority that intends to move forward. That's sufficient consensus. You know, Chair, we have been robbed through these contested things. Sometimes, you know, we should have not even defined. I'm just in touch.
All right. No, no, but may I please suppress you? Just make progress. I recognize you.
No, you know to me earlier.
Okay. Okay. Shall we recognize or remember Kasim?
Chair, please protect me from the comments as well. Please, I'm asking that. I direct you to yourself here because there's many comments that have been made here without recognition. Please protect me from those. Chair, I raised my hand earlier with a clarity-seeking question. Rather than even a proposal with this long discussion, it was a clarity-seeking question. Because last week, when we had discussed this at the initiation of this process, when we had discussed this, it wasn't about sections that needed law advisors to go back and rework. That was not what we had discussed. We had said that where there is an agreement on sections, then we are going to define, we are going to note those agreements in sections. There was evidence, if you can recall, Jefferson, your evidence from yourself must be use the word resolve or note, whatever the case may be. But we'll note there's an agreement across those. And those sections where there is a disagreement, whether it's put one dissenting or I'm one dissenting member, whatever I am, I don't care what it is. But where was a disagreement? We are going to come back to the sections as a methodology, as a committee, when we are going close by close, and then we are going to come back to resolve in those sections. Now, if you want to rule otherwise on methodology, that's fine, Chairperson. I was asking a clarity-seeking question. I was not submitting a proposal for discussion as is taking place here.
Okay, Honourable Member, Professor Pozzoli.
It seems to me to be in the essence of democracy that we note majority and minority opinions. So all we really need to do with this clause is to note so there are some people who continue not to be happy with this. But we don't need to keep discussing it. I think we can just leave it. We are going to vote on this, all clauses.
and our opportunity for expressing our opinion again will come when we vote. We also have a written amendment which we'd like to propose to this clause, and I don't know procedurally when we're supposed to do that. I did read it out, but I think we have it here. And I don't know how procedurally that works. Maybe the committee secretary can advise us. So our disagreement was perfectly legitimate. I mean, it's part of how one does things. It's not a crime, it's not a problem, it's just how things are. And we would like our disagreement to be noted, but we're not voting on it today. So there doesn't need to be a call for a consensus or whatever. Just noting that this clause, there's some people who are happy with it and some aren't, and we move on. But I do need clarity procedurally on how we express our disagreement. Do we put our amendment forward now? Do we put it forward in Parliament? Do we put it forward when we vote? So if we could just have clarity on procedurally, because it's the first time I've done this. Thank you.
Well, in my consultation with the content advice, I'm sure you saw me talking to him, I said, please note all those areas where other members are differing, so that when we discuss, I said, we highlight them, and then that way we will be voting. So that procedurally, when you vote, it's also in terms of the rules. You vote and note those who have not agreed on that thing, on the, but you also acknowledge and recognize sufficient consensus, and also register those that have not agreed on the matter. But it does not, but then because of the majority rule principle, that clause would then be accepted. It's in the rules.
You take
note of those that are differing, but you recognize sufficient consensus, which allows you to go ahead with whatever that is under discussion.
But we don't do that now, we do it when we vote.
Yeah, yes.
What about the amendment?
I'm trying to say, as a chairperson, I had already warned them to say, please highlight those areas where we not all agree. Because at the end, we will have to reflect that as we discuss, there was sufficient consensus and register the dissenting view. Dissenting view is not an insult, honourable member, it's a political, it's always used in politics. You dissent, it's either in a dissenting view, you are differing.
Dissenting members, said like that generally is an insult. You can have dissenting views.
Chair, I think that's the general feeling of myself and perhaps Mr. Custin, is that because we have disagreed with this clause, we are somehow other deviating from what's expected. This is not the case. We are performing our role. We are being diligent and professional about what we've done, and I think that needs to be recognised. We've worked very hard on the bill, and we have the right to say what we've said. And I don't like the insinuations that have come from other members of this committee every time we disagree.
Okay, shall we refocus and continue the meeting? And in the same team spirit that we started with, it will assist us. And you must know that all those who voted us want us to do that. You know, rise above and take decisions that will be in the best interest of the country. Because we are all building this nation. So we are expected then to take decisions that will be in the best interest of the country. But because we are a democratic government, then democratic principles will apply. In terms of, if there are many people who are agreeing on, and that those that who have a dissenting view, you note them as such. Alright. Do you want to take this discussion further? I thought maybe I've rounded it up for you, and then we can then proceed with the next talk. Because remember, we're doing what we have not come here to do now.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Chair, I think we must understand that the routine of the discussion goes in this fashion. As soon as there is an acceptable position of view from other members that states correctly that they are not for that opinion or for that is going forward. In legal terms and in many constitutional terms, it is dissent. There is no other definition, which means you are acceptable to hold on to your view. There is nothing that is meant to mean any form or shape that is bad. As long as you have raised and formalized your different view from the rest, it's called different. And I do not know how we're going to be able to move forward if we are not accepting that people do not agree with certain views. It's a normal process.
Okay, I have already ruled on the matter. Shall we then proceed with the business of this meeting? And then we then move on to clause number 17. In the absence of input, we then move on to clause number 18. Sub-clause A. Sub-clause B. Sub-clause C. We now move to clause 19, sub-clause A, sub-clause B, C, D. We move on to clause 20. Sub-clause A, sub-clause B,
this is not really controversial at all. And section.
I don't mean that.
So I'm trying to assist him. No, in making my point, I'm trying to assist myself in making my point. Section 49A.
It's
the Bill. 24th the Bill. Yes. In the relevant section of the Act is 49A.
Mm-hmm.
This deals with the liability of the independent assessor. It seems as if maybe this wasn't thought through very well, Chairperson. Section B means if the assessor is liable if the assessor may use of alcohol or drugs. Now, if the editor had a glass of wine in the evening, he'd be liable, according to this
bit of legislation, or drugs, if I not say unlawful drugs, you could have taken medication, which is a drug, it is a medical drug, and therefore he is liable. It also says that this is acted recklessly or intentionally under subsection D. Now, surely you'd want the assessor to always act intentionally. Why would it be recklessly or maybe intentionally reckless would be a better way to phrase that. But if you say recklessly or intentionally, surely everything the assessor does is intentional unless he's doing unintentional things. And then it says the assessor, without prior consultation with the state attorney, made an admission that is detrimental to the best interests of our education. Now, this could really make an assessor liable if the assessor is a whistleblower, for example. Okay? It's also very, very vague. And the wrongful instances of wrongful disclosure would fall under paragraphs A and D in any case. And therefore, this section is absolutely redundant in that case. That's number V. No, sorry. Give me 1 second. Number E. Without prior consultation, the state attorney made an admission that was detrimental to the best interest of education. Now, I could argue that if I was so low on something, it could not be in the best interest of higher education. I mean, that argument will go either way. So therefore, the three things that I want to amend here, Chairperson, is to say that, just give me a second, the section E be removed, that we say that under B, but under the influence of alcohol or an illegal narcotic at the time the relevant conduct occurred.
Okay.
And
yeah, you know why? Yeah.
Let me
check with other members so that
you can
drop.
Before I put my proposals.
Huh?
Before I put my
proposal
amendment.
You made a proposal on
the subclause B of 409A. I want to find out. Okay, sure. So that you don't drop everything here. Agreed? Honourable member. Okay, just before Honourable Patsy, I just want to get the views of the advocate because this has a lot to do with some of the presenters and some of the presenters and some of the views that were taken care of. I just want to understand, is this the new or is it part of the old and what are its intentions now? Because we need to understand the idea.
Sir, it is not in the current act. The issue of indemnification of the independent assessor has been one of the issues raised by the ESA and the other role players as a major problem, because the independent assessor and the role that that report is playing becomes a very critical, and the individual can be exposed. And what we've provided for is an approach which is similar to what you would find is applicable to indemnification of a public servant performing official duties, and where there are certain exclusions. So the principle of giving protection when you are performing your function diligently, that if you are using alcohol when you are performing that function, when you are dealing with a decision that you are correct, you don't, if it's legal or illegal, it doesn't matter, it is a problem, because that person should, if it is legal drugs, then he should identify it, and the implications of that should have been known to the minister, because the issue is you must have a rationale for, first of all, that there is this principle, but it's also object of limitations. And if there is anything that could have deal with the ability of the individual that will be affected. If they are a person that is making specific statements out of context and binding the minister in an improper manner, that is what we try to address. We are also trying to deal with the best interests of the legislative framework that we are dealing with, and we are providing a limitation that it is arising out of using of support processes. For instance, it can be a person who gets a vehicle to do his job and he is in an accident. That type of issues must also be regulated in a similar manner that we've dealt with a public servant. So the answer is no, it is not in the current legislation. The principle is purely driven that it is a high risk for challenges, and the individual should not be exposed in a personal capacity if that person is doing his or her job correctly. And lastly, if there is a indemnification, it must be limited through objective criteria to not just open the state for unnecessary claims. That's the principles behind it.
Yes, Chairperson, I think from what I'm hearing, Honourable Kim is making some comments which I think we should consider, but I just want to have clarity from a legal perspective. Certainly there should be wording that is utilised in law. I mean, for instance, if we outlaw drugs, what we know what we mean by drugs, but if the independent assessor is on chronic medication, you know, I mean that is on drugs. So what should one not look at something that describes what the intention is? Secondly, just clarity from a legal perspective point of view. How do you act? It's clear when you act recklessly, but how do you act intentionally? You intentionally doing your work? What does it mean? So can we perhaps just elaborate a little further on in law and where did they derive the wording from? Chair, thank you very much. I think Honourable Kasim wants to make some suggestions how we take it forward, but just clarity from a legal perspective, from those involved in drafting. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah, very quick one. The first one is that Honourable Kasim must be aware, shouldn't accuse us later, that when he asks clarities, they provoke discussion at times. And that is in the normal way of doing things. It is not the digression, it's just in the normal way. For example, this one, the way the advocate is explaining it, I understand it well because I know there are legal drugs, medication that you take and immediately you feel sleepy. And if in the job of the assessor, the administrator, that could, like he has explained, lead to an accident because he took his medication, knowing well enough that this is the medication that will make me sleepy and I can't drive a long distance, that will be reckless. So, in the way they are explaining it, it makes sense that whether it is legal or illegal drugs, make sure that when you do it, it doesn't have negative effects. And that makes sense to me. So, I would go along with what it says here because it makes total sense to me.
Okay, shall we then allow Honourable Member?
Out of respect, Chair, I will do that.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Chair, the proposal is
was under the influence of alcohol or an illegal narcotic at the time the relevant conduct occurred. That would rule out if, for example, the assessor decided to have a glass of wine in the evening with his meal when he was off duty, but he wasn't in the assessment period, or if he decided to take a Panado, for example, or any other drug, and so forth. There were concerns raised by Honorable Kikana in terms of recklessness would then be captured under Section D.
Okay. Let's finish with Section D. There's a proposal that we amend and add the proposal by Honorable
I was just going to contextualize it, Chairman. The reason that the provision is structured like that, Chairman, is because these factors that are listed here are factors that are in currently in the treasury regulations, where you are protected from liability as an officer, but we couldn't transpose the treasury regulations as they are, because they don't apply to public bodies such as universities, for instance, and people who are independent assessors. So we took the contents of what is there as it is and put it here. All these things that are listed here, what are exceptions in the treasury regulations for you to lose the liability that you're given by the state if you're an official performing your duties and then you then have liability. I think the reason is it is like that,
Chairman. Okay. That's fine. What do I take? Remember, this is our day now. We have made a proposal in God's sanity, so what's our day?
Thank you very much. There is reference to my clarity seeking question earlier. Under normal circumstances, there has always been a feeling that the assessors were not properly protected. And I think you must remember, Chairperson, the intention of any bill first is for goodwill. Before you can describe the evil, the goodwill here is aimed at providing protection to a person who's doing a dear job, asked by the state, asked by a minister to do a good job. Now, the intention is to cover that person on conditions of good grounds. I think that should be our first assumption in assessing this. There is nothing intentionally here meant to promote any evil. However, you have to isolate certain instances that will not be covered. Ordinarily, in the set of events of pursuing even a good job. I think that's to me what is intended. And I think amending it slightly and amending it broadly, it may actually create a runaway agreement where we are not able to know where is this protection ending. And I think if it ends here, we're all clear. You do your job, you are protected, and all circumstances cover a sound mind person having pursued a dear job. And any other unsound mind person having pursued a dear job, then there is a problem.
Thank you, sir. No, with regards to B, I think we should retain it as is. For me, the explanation given is sufficient, and we may stick to it.
Thank you, Chairperson. I also move that we retain it as is.
Chairperson, I will accept it if it is the current provision in the treasury regulations. In fact, if it applies, because if you look at it, an independent assessor is actually performing a part-time responsibility as a public, as a so-called public official, because he's appointed to investigate a matter, and therefore, for the duration of that period, he should comply with what the rest of the public service has to comply with. So, for that reason, not all my questions have been answered, but broadly speaking, I think I understand.
Yeah, I think the exception that you forget my name. I support the intention of this, and just to support Honorable Keenan, whether it's temporary or permanent, I think the principle still holds that whoever performs this duty must be protected. So I go for the retention.
Okay. In the main, all members are proposing that we change it as it is. That proposal, they are agreeing that we retain it as it is, and then we take note of the honorable members' interview.
I think Honorable Ken asked a very important question that was not answered as to what is the purpose of saying reckless or intentional. What did they not mean intentionally reckless?
Thank you, Chairperson. Basically, the two words are used for purposes of criminal sanction and criminal prosecution. When an act is reckless, it's when you did not have an intention, but circumstances within what was happening forced you to act. For instance, when you kill someone while under the influence, sometimes it may be said it was a reckless killing of another person because you were not completely in your full senses to be aware that you will kill someone. But when you drink and knowing that you're still going to drive, then there is an intention. So basically what intentionally means is that you did something knowing fully well what would be the consequences, and recklessly means that you did something without knowing the chances of the consequences that might arise. That's basically the term that I use, as I said, for prosecution purposes. And when you define crime, that when you've acted wrongly, the crime must have an intention, must have an act which the law has made unlawful, and then you did the conduct, basically. It's the distinction between what you do negligently and what you do with an intention to do what you have done. Thank you.
No, look, I understand, Chairperson. I just think that whether this is taken from treasury regulations or from where, the wording could be better. Perhaps they should be admission in that regard. But I mean, I think it would be better where it is intentionally reckless. I think that covers exactly what you're trying to say. Because if you say reckless... Chair, I just want to ask a question here. And can you please repeat me from Honorable Mbatha, because he's been a guest of this entire session. Yes, but you're not on the floor, Chair. Chair, I'm still on the floor.
Honorable Kasim is very strict with the rules of the committee, but he's not strict to himself because he interjects, he doesn't raise his hand 3 times now. He's just been shouting at you and speaking as he wish. I'd like to call him to order because as if a person wants to follow rules to the latter, I think he should set the example. cannot just sit on the mic and type. We can't operate like that.
Yes, I was on the floor. I was that nice. But maybe on what kind of a stage, I was still on the floor when I was talking now, and I was being interjected. See, what I'm asking is, as the act currently reads, okay, if you read it, the amendment, it says, with regard to the act or omission, is liable in law and guilty of the following acts. D, acted recklessly or intentionally. Therefore, the O says, no, it's not recklessly and intentionally. The O says acted intentionally. And what are the implications of that? Is that not clumsy, Jefferson? That is the concern that I was raising. Because to me that seems clumsy, unless it's recklessly and intentionally, or it's intentionally reckless. And therefore I am raising that concern as a member of the committee, Jefferson.
In my view, in the legal jargon, the three are green, and they say that this one is in the standard practice, so we can't change. So then we are also asked members if they are green after getting the explanation, and then they so the majority of the members have agreed on this. So shall we then open it? Alright, otherwise, you know, we have a sitting at 2. What's happening is you have my permission to leave? As long as you bow. Okay, no, that's what I'm saying is to prescribe the rules. But I was saying, yeah, we've had a marathon of people that we gave today, unlike the other day. But it's fine, in life you must respect that. Yeah? If it's where you differ, can we do it? And then where members, where there was consensus, if it's there, if it's where we have consensus, we also accept it. But I would like us to end here today so that members can go and prepare themselves for the current meeting. And then we will then proceed. I'm sure this is our last meeting. We will then proceed in the next meeting, that we'll be starting on each day. Yeah. 12th of April. The meeting starts on the 12th of April. What will be the next day of our meeting? Okay, we will communicate the next day where we will be considering the technology. And then members should be flexible so that you allow us to define space. Where we have found space, let's adjust our program so that we can come from there. I put it to be proceeding. We don't stop the process of our day to complete. I'm sure you will help me to support my proposal so that it is going to take for the next day.
Chipson, I'm fine with it. It's just that, are we going to just leave section 24? Because there was another proposal under section 24. Or are we going to come back to that? Yes, we were still busy with that. So. Change it to section E. The assistant was asked prior consultation with the state attorney made an admission that was detrimental to the best interests of higher education. My concern here is that the paragraph is not only vague, but it also smacks of a whistleblower prosecution for being taken away the indemnity in this, or the protection in this regard, just if there is an admission that was made that was not first consulted with the state attorney. In any case, under section section A and section B, any type of reckless behavior or the intention to exceed the powers of the independent assessor is already covered in those sections. And I don't see a reason why the section is then included. And I would then propose that this paragraph be removed, section E.
The issue of E is when you are in a situation where you are forced to make a statement or you tender a specific admission which will bind the state in the liability, then you must first get legal advice. Now the legal advice in order to deal with it in a specific structure is that the legal advice is normally coming from the state attorney, and therefore it will also limit the additional costs in that regard. So the issue here is if a person is performing function, and that function is within specific terms and conditions, that is the official job, and if it is, I have an implication that it's similar to that of a whistleblower, then that is the terms of reference, and that terms of reference by nature will allow that person to perform the official job by identifying specific problems. So it might have whistleblowing similarities, but it is a job that is done. By the moment that person moves outside the terms of reference, dealing with issues that expose that person to a specific claim, then it is important that you deal with it with specific legal advice before that person makes admissions which will bind the state in the final analysis. Because the indemnity would then becomes a, or can have the potential to become a milking cow, where you can drain resources from the state, where a person willingly make confessions because there's no implications to that individual. But if that person is performing his job or her job, if that person is diligent and there is a claim against that person will just get the advice of a legal expert in the state attorney's office to say, no, don't make any, what the word here is admissions, and admissions means that you are fully accepting all responsibility pertaining to that specific conduct. And that is what it's all about.
Yeah, I've got a clarification question, if I may. And I suppose it will assist her. I understand where the department and is what is the department trying to achieve by this. Would that not be achieved anyways under subsection A? Intentionally exceeded his or her powers. Would that same end, because you're saying if someone acted outside of their terms of reference, that's what you are worried about. Therefore, if they acted outside of the terms of reference, they have exceeded his or her powers as an independent assessor anyways. So my question is, is it not covered by the section anyway, rather than have this other vague section that can encompass whistleblowers?
Yeah, is going wider, because there it is a person who volunteers and admits to accept liability, because that is the effect of an admission. You accept liability. Now, if you are not to pay for it and the state is going to pay for it, it is just important that the legal expert, because this independent assessor is not a legal person, just get the necessary advice before binding the minister to pay for those damages made on that admission. So the issue of intentionally exceeding his powers is actually the conduct, but this is an admission relating to the conduct, which is binding the state in the term of damages and accepting liability for those debts.
Well, wishing the hostage, you know, I would really accept that we need it, because to me there will be no harm. So that she's a city for her from this other area. And to me, if you read it, it commits the assessor to confirm with a state law advisor before. And if he has not, so if it's not written, he might argue that because it's not in the air. So for now, committed to ask for legal advice, which is a very good provision, and it protects the state as well. Because this is a person independent who is coming back on behalf of the state, but he must also, and that's who's going to be charged if nation and the state is doing it. So this one commits him to consult state, so that he does not make costly mistakes to the state or to the minister's reputation.
Chairperson, then I have I understand the intention behind it, but I have a problem with the word. If an independent assessor makes an admission of some sort of wrongdoing by the minister or the deputy minister of the department and so forth, that's got nothing to do with liability, for example. This person can be, the identity can be taken away in that regard. So let's say if, and a lot of it has got to do with where the fault lies or if something is made, disclosed in the public domain in this regard, I am concerned that would then leave this independent assessor out in the cold. Because how do you then define what's in the best interest of higher education as the wording is contained here?
Yeah, okay, I just want, maybe there's a misdirection. When we talk about this indemnification and the admission, there's the admission of the independent assessor relating to his or her work that person has performed. It is not the work and the terms of reference is not if the minister or the deputy minister did something wrong. Because the minister and the deputy minister is not subject of the investigation. The investigation is about what is happening in the institution and how they conduct themselves within that operations of that institution and in relation to the legislative framework and the requirements applicable to that institution. So if that person makes a finding in his or her focus and deliberations and the outcome of the investigation, that person can't then just admit that yes, I'm wrong, and because it's easy to for the minister to pay, it is first go and get advice. It might be a wrong perception, and that's all we are saying here. It is not to protect the minister or the deputy minister. It is not to avoid him to raise the or the whistleblower. If it is part, if the minister is implicated in it, which I don't think it is possible because the focus is on the activities of the institution, then the issue is for that person to say that, are you really in the scope of your terms of reference? If you're outside it and you're whistleblowing, then you've got protection in any event, but then you don't do it within your official focus as an independent assessor. And the advice would then also be split it to. And the legal advice can assist that person not to become entangled and provide a wrong outcome to a right and good intention. The leeway is still there. What we are dealing here is purely within the scope of the terms of reference. And that person may let missions get advice before you make it. If there is a rationale, a reason why you want to make the admission, fine. If there's not, then you stop, you don't do it, and whoever makes an allegation must come and prove, and you don't need to commit or put the minister in an untenable position where damages must be paid, which was not necessary if it was properly handled.
Okay. Yeah, with that understanding, shall we move on to another sub-clause if there's any other sub-clause that we would like to consider under clause 29. All right. That then, yeah, as I have told you, that we will then end up here, and then this passage, and then as we go back, so that we don't forget, let's read this inspiration for the next teaching. And we come to the meeting, we to text in the so that we share the time.
Thank you.